Yeah, I'd like to say another welcome to everybody that's here this morning. We have several folks that are visiting with us. Most, I believe, if not all, are people that have been with us previously. Maybe a few that have not. In any case, we're really glad you've gotten to come our way, and we look forward so often to seeing those who visit with us periodically. Hope you'll get lots more opportunities to be back with us and to join us in our time of worship. At this particular juncture of the year, I am usually teaching a course over at Florida College on the subject of Old Testament poetry and wisdom literature. And that means that about this time of the semester, I come to the book of Proverbs. And each time I work through that, I am reminded of how many valuable lessons there are in that book, and especially how many valuable lessons there are in that book for young people. There are certain parts of the Bible that are expressly directed towards young people. And I think two of the books that most clearly and obviously are so directed are the books of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. As a matter of fact, in the opening chapters of the book of Proverbs, the father who is doing the teaching constantly addresses his son and says, "Son, listen to what I'm telling you." He'll say, "Hear my instruction." Sometimes he says, "Hear the instruction of your mother and your father." But usually, it's "Hear my instruction." This book is directed especially towards young people, and yet all of us can look at it and find things that help us to better cope with the problems of life. I want to present a lesson this morning summarizing what I see as some of the main lessons, by no means all of them, but some of the main lessons and some of the very important and valuable lessons from this book to young people. And I want to pick up on one of the images of the book of Proverbs as sort of the structuring basis for our lesson this morning. One of the favorite images used throughout the book is that of a net or a snare, things you can get tangled up in. And of course, one of their primary means of hunting, they did hunt with bows and arrows and spears and so forth, but one of the main means of hunting wild animals was to hunt with a net or a snare, some type of trap in which you get the animal entangled. Perhaps you've been tangled up in something and known the frustration of being tangled up in something, just physically tangled up, or gotten something tangled up. Any of you ever go fishing very much? As a little kid, you know very much about getting something so tangled up you can't possibly hope to get it untangled. I used to get my dad's fishing reel that way periodically. But this is talking about us being trapped, ensnared in something from which it seems you just can't extricate yourself. And as I say, a lot of Proverbs use this image. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 2 talks about being snared with the words of your mouth. Or chapter 7 and verse 23 describes a person who gets involved with an adulterous woman as a bird that hasteth to the snare, kind of a stupid bird that would go running to see how quickly he could get caught. Bad companions, warning about an angry man, says, don't associate with him lest you learn his ways and get a snare to your soul. The sluggard even is described as somebody who makes his own snare. The way of the sluggard is as a hedge of thorns, a particularly painful type of trap or snare in which to be tangled up in. Well, I want to suggest some of these things as special warnings. And so we're going to be talking this morning about entanglements. Entanglements particularly for young people to avoid. And if I somewhat identify at times with the older person as the speaker of Proverbs, maybe it's because I'm in recent years a father. Maybe it's because in recent years I've had occasion to think much more about some of these things from the perspective of the person who's been through and sometimes been entangled and been snared and had to extricate himself or seek God's help in extrication. But it is precisely that experience that lies behind the teaching of the father to his son. And so here are some things to avoid. And the first is entanglements with the wrong crowd. I invite you to look at Proverbs chapter 1, and I want to pick up in verse 10 here. When you study the book of Proverbs, the passage that Kevin read for us just a few moments ago is usually, so that's sort of the preamble, that's the introduction to the book. And it culminates with a keynote statement in verse 7, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, while fools despise wisdom and instruction. And then after that, you might say, now what's the first thing this father is going to tell his son? Verse 8, he says, hear my son, your father's instruction. He says, I'm getting ready to open up to you now and tell you the wisdom of life. And so what's the first thing out of the chute that he's going to want to tell his son? And he says to him in verse 10, my son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait for blood, let us ambush the innocent without cause. He says, watch out. He says, they are after you. And he even uses that image of the snare and being caught up in the snare that they set a little bit later. I say to those of you who are young people here, whether they'll acknowledge it or not, one of the things your parents have been vitally concerned about for a long, long time, and continue to be so, is who your friends are. Who do you hang around with? Who do you associate with? And what type of people are they? And the reason they are concerned about that is they know that the older you get, the more and more those you choose as your friends influence what type of person you are becoming. Indeed, I would suggest, just as a sort of a rule of thumb, be very careful about picking your friends. Because when you pick your friends, you're basically picking who you're going to be. You surround yourself with a certain type of person and you become like that person. As a matter of fact, in Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 20, it seems to me that is essentially the point that is being made. Proverbs chapter 13, verse 20, he who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. So when you're choosing your friends and who you're going to associate with, pick wisely. Pick wise people. Pick good people. Pick honest people. Pick humble people. Pick people that you would like to be like. Pick people who are like Jesus. The more you pick people for your friends that you see as emulating the qualities of our Lord Himself, the more that's going to help you be like the Lord. But the more you entangle yourself with the wrong kind of people, the more difficult you will find it to be able to be the type of person you professed and committed your life to be when you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 19. Proverbs 20 and verse 19 says, he who goes about as a slanderer reveals secrets. Therefore, do not associate with a gossip. We're always saying, you know, we shouldn't spread gossip. I want to tell you, and I speak from experience, I never think of myself as a particularly gossipy person. But I want to tell you, when you hear a good bit of juicy stuff about somebody, it's awfully hard not to tell. It's hard. How do you avoid spreading gossip? Don't hear it. How do you avoid hearing it? Don't be with a person. Don't associate with a person that's a gossip. You say, I wouldn't do that. I mean, my best friends all do, but I wouldn't. I'd almost promise you, if all your best friends gossip, you do too. I just almost promise you that that's the case. Because we become those that we associate with. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 24. Proverbs 22 and verse 24 says, do not associate with a man given to anger or go with a hot-tempered man. Again, why? You hang around with people who don't exercise self-control and you're not going to have self-control. And I might add a little parenthetical statement to those of us who are parents and older and setting examples. When we talk about saying these things to our young people, it becomes important for us not to be gossips, not to be hot-headed. Because that's who our kids spend an awful lot of time with associating for quite a number of years. And it's awfully hard for them to become something other than what they've seen us set before them as an example. But to return especially to those, notice in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 24, where he says, don't associate with a hot-tempered man given anger, or go with a hot-tempered man. Notice the very next verse, lest you learn his ways and find a snare for yourself. You'll be tangled up in all of the difficulties that he gets himself into by not controlling his temper. And then in Proverbs chapter 23 and verse 20 says, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine or with gluttonous eaters of meat. Don't associate with them. You say, well, I wouldn't do that. I associate with a lot of my friends do that, but I wouldn't do that. If a lot of your friends do that, either you're going to become like them, or sooner or later, you're going to have a parting of the ways. And so the father, first thing he said to his son is, watch out who you associate with. The wrong crowd can turn you away from the Lord, get you tangled up in things that you'll never be able to escape from. Another thing he warns his son about. Turn to Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs chapter 7. Several times in these opening chapters, the wise man counsels against sexual entanglements. God made us a sexual people. There is hardly anything that is more powerful. It may vary for different people, but there's hardly anything that's more powerful as a part of who and what we are. And it can be a great blessing as God has provided for the sexual desire to be fulfilled and satisfied. God made it powerful that indeed it might be a powerful blessing, but can also be a powerful, corrupting, and destructive force as well. And so in Proverbs chapter 7, he says, starting in verse 1, my son, keep my words and treasure my commandments within you. Keep my commandments and live. And he's going to tell him about an entanglement that can lead him to death. Verse 6, he says, at the window of my house, I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive, I discerned among the youths, a young man lacking sense, passing through the street near her corner. And he takes the way to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, and in the darkness. And if I understand correctly, he is describing a young man that he is observing from perhaps an upper story window looking out into the street below. And somewhere within sight, there is the house of a woman described here as an adulterous woman. And I'll say a word about that in just a moment. But a woman that is apparently known in the community as a source of sexual pleasure. And if I'm reading this correctly, what he is describing is the young man that goes by several times successively in the twilight, the evening, the middle of the night, and the darkness. And it's sort of like probably, no, I wouldn't do that, but I do want to see. I do want to know what that's about. I'd like to see what she looks like, something to that effect. And he has no idea the snare he is stepping into. She comes out to meet him, dressed as a harlot and cunning of heart. And dressed as a harlot doesn't mean that she looks ugly and repulsive. She looks attractive and seductive. But she's the type of woman that will destroy him. Verse 13, she seizes him, kisses him with a brazen face. She says to him, basically, come on in. Verse 18, come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let's delight ourselves with caresses, for the man is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. And I said I would say something about the fact that she is described consistently throughout these chapters as an adulterous woman. We look at this and say, but we're not married. Yes, that's true. There's a big social difference between our society and theirs. If you lived in their world, you would have been married, almost all of you. Most young women were married by 13, 14, 15 years of age. And most young men by 17 or 18 were married. They didn't have teenagers. They had children and they had adults. And that was it. And you went straight from one to the other. And while fornication was a problem, usually the Bible talks not about fornication, but about adultery. But I would also suggest an important lesson here too. And that is, a lot of times young people feel like, well, if I take some sexual liberties or step too far now, soon I will be married, and then the problems will go away. I want you to notice, the father's addressing his son, assuming his son is assuming the marriage relationship, at least on the part of this woman, and elsewhere on the part of the son himself. If you look back to chapter 5, he's clearly talking about a married son there. And the father knows that those types of sexual temptations do not disappear with marriage. And he warns him from that perspective. Don't make the mistake of thinking that sexual license now will be taken care of simply by the process of marriage. And so the warning about the snare, the trap, the entanglement, and the warning that I would extend to you as young people, realize that you live in a sexually charged society, a society in which almost every aspect of entertainment, recreation, of storytelling, anything you can think of, tends to be highly sexually charged. And it's a difficult path for a Christian to learn to take those steps that will lead away from the snare and the trap to that which is faithful and godly. I want to suggest that I think we at times tend to oversimplify it. I mean, I warn people about the dangers of dancing. Now, there's a lot of dancing in the Bible, lots of dancing. You get a concordance out and look it up. A lot of it. But it's very different from the type of dancing that people do mostly in our society. Most of the dancing, and most of the dancing you find yourself tempted to participate in, is explicitly sexual in its nature. It's not the folk dancing like they would have been doing when the prodigal son came home that we read about in Luke chapter 15. But we'll preach about that. We'll talk about warning young people about the dangers of dancing. I want to tell you that I know what happens. I know what happens to a lot of the young people at school where I teach. They wouldn't dance for love nor money, so to speak. But they'll go out and park in a car. And sometimes we miss the point. The real issue is which path are we really traveling? Not are we following the rules that somebody has said, you got to do this, and as long as you don't do this, you're okay. Now, the real issue is, are we making ourselves pure and holy before God, and are we avoiding that which leads to death? The fellow, every time he starts talking about the adulterous woman here in this chapter, he ends up talking about death. He says to his son, suddenly he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter. But I want to move on. I want to talk about entanglement with alcohol. Turn to Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs 23rd chapter. Pick up in verse 29. It says, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine, those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, and your mind will utter perverse things. And you will be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. They struck me, but I did not become ill. They beat me, but I did not know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. The warning here is that alcohol is a powerful trap into which many people fall. I understand that about 10% of the people who drink socially become alcoholics. I don't know how many just get drunk. And drunkenness is what the Bible calls a sin. But I want to address young people, particularly as young people in their situation right here. I want you to think about the reasons young people want to drink. I would not argue, and I try to be very cautious about saying this, I would not try to argue, as some have, that every time you read about somebody drinking something in the Bible, particularly a godly person, that it was non-alcoholic. I wouldn't try to argue that. I think that's just not right. But I want to tell you there's a world of difference in what they did and what I think most young people do when they find themselves tempted to drink. What are the reasons young people drink? To prove you're an adult? An expression of rebellion? An instrument for partying and having a good time? If you don't drink enough to get high, what's the point? I want to suggest that alcohol is a powerful gateway drug in our society. By gateway drug, what I mean is, like smoking. If some people do that because so many people do it, it seems innocent and acceptable, but it becomes the first barrier that you break down. And then you say, well, from there on to other things that you smoke, other things that you drink or ingest or take in or inhale. There's some interesting statistics on the number of people who take drugs, harder drugs and so forth, and whether or not they smoked and drank earlier. Almost invariably, they do. It's also frequently an instrument for seduction. One recent article I saw indicated that 60% of the students who drink at a major state university here in Florida say they drink to get drunk. And there have recently been a whole series of articles on binge drinking and that particular problem on college campuses. Most have become alcoholics starting their teenage years. Most develop some problems as early as their teenage years. You think about, to what does the very existence of an organization like Alcoholics Anonymous testify as to the danger of this? The seriousness of the problem in our world seems to me to be attested to by the fact that almost every state has some minimum age for drinking, 18, 19, 21, all of which are well above what would have been considered an adult in Bible times. And these restrictions are imposed not by Christians, but by a society that generally accepts and encourages drinking. They may accept and encourage it, but they know the danger of alcohol in a young person behind a car. My point is not don't drink while you're young, but it'll be okay when you grow up. That's exactly what the world around you is saying, and they've hardly solved the problem, as our many institutions trying to deal with this testify to. That's one of the main reasons young people want to drink, to prove that they are grown up. I offer this just as sort of personal wisdom. Proverbs says, watch out. This is a danger, a snare that can destroy your life. I'm going to suggest if you don't drink while you're young, when you grow up, you'll find there's no real point to anyway. And all of the reasons that seem so important when you're young will seem so very insignificant. But I want to move on to another entanglement, financial entanglements. Proverbs is wonderfully practical. A lot of times we don't think of financial issues as moral issues at all, but they are. A Christian needs to act responsibly and morally in every aspect of his life. And that includes the way he handles his finances. Being a Christian doesn't automatically guarantee that you're going to associate with the right people, or that you're not going to be subject to sexual temptation, or that you are going to handle your finances and your money responsibly and rightly. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 1. My son, says the father, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared with the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth by entering into such an agreement, he says, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself, since you have come into the hand of your neighbor. Go humble yourself and importune your neighbor. That means beg him, and beg him over and over. Do not give sleep to your eyes nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand or like the bird from the hand of a fowler. Now, what's he talking about? He says, if you got into this situation, you get out of it if you possibly can. If you have been surety for your neighbor, some translations will say if you have struck hands with your neighbor, the expression to strike hands or to be surety for, basically what it means, I mean very specifically what it means, cosign on a loan. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Cosign on a loan. But the big point is, you got tangled up in somebody else's finances in a bad financial situation. He says, if you start finding yourself getting tangled up in somebody else's financial situation, that you're taking their debts and you're promising to pay them. Now, he's not saying not to help somebody that's poor or help somebody that's in need. He's talking about getting yourself tangled up financially. He says, realize that that can be a terrible trap. And I want to suggest that probably most of you young people today are not extraordinarily tempted to co-sign on somebody else's loan. You may have begged mom and daddy to co-sign on a loan when you bought a car or something like that, but that's not the big temptation for you. But I want to tell you, you've got all sorts of financial temptations out there. I ask a class at school this just the other day. I asked them how many had already started receiving solicitations for credit cards. And I think everybody in class raised their hand. Well, there's certainly nothing immoral about getting credit cards, but I want to tell you, you can get tangled up in financial obligations that you will have a moral responsibility to meet far more than you can even begin to imagine how long it'll take you to get out of if you don't watch out. And I was talking about a number of people that drink that become alcoholics. I don't know what the statistics are on the number of people that use credit cards that end up basically going bankrupt and having to cut them all up. It's not 10%, I don't think, but there's a significant number of people. Now, I'm not telling you can't use a credit card. I am telling you to realize that you have a moral obligation and responsibility to financial commitments that you make. And you can get tangled up in things that will not only cause you difficulty, but embarrass the cause of Christ. You know, somebody that's not responsible in the way they handle their finances, somebody knows that they are a Christian, and that becomes obvious that they don't meet their obligations. That reflects on the gospel of Christ, just like other types of dishonorable behavior do. And so beware of those. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 7 says, "The borrower is servant to the lender." So if you want to become a slave, borrow some money. Next, entanglements of the sluggard. I'm going to kind of hit this one a light lick, not because I think it's unimportant. The fact is, different people will be more or less affected by various items that we're talking about right here. Some may find themselves perfectly able to handle financial matters, but not so good at exercising proper discretion in sexual matters. Others may have trouble with alcohol. Others may have trouble just with the people they associate with and what that leads them to. Others may have trouble with laziness. I will point out, the book of Proverbs has a lot to say about this too. And I would emphasize that in the book of Proverbs, it's not just a sort of a funny character trait, but it is, in fact, a moral issue. If you go looking at references to the sluggard and the slack of hand and so forth in the book of Proverbs, you'll find it's consistently opposed to some to the righteous and to the upright. And even said it's a brother to one who steals. But the point there, too, is that there's another set of entanglements. I'm going to, as I say, skip over that one in light of time and move to the last, entanglements of the tongue. Perhaps in no circumstance is the image of the snare more frequent in the book of Proverbs than in that of the tongue itself. Proverbs chapter 12. And verse 13, "An evil man is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous will escape from trouble." And I would suggest that several of the items above often involve the use of the tongue as well. In the case of the financial entanglements, making commitments, promises to somebody financially, in case of the wrong crowd, in case of sexual encounters, very often the tongue is a part of that as well. But one of the primary instructions of the book of Proverbs, and particularly one of the primary snares that is identified, is that of the tongue and the need for self-control or restraint in our words. Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 19 says that where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable, but he who restrains his lips is wise. Now, sometimes I think I have made the mistake of trying to figure out exactly what he meant by where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. I said, well, is he talking about this type of situation or that type of situation? Is he talking about the person who says a lot? Probably there's some underlying sin there that he's trying to cover. Is he saying the more you talk, the more you're apt to get into trouble? I think it's probably the latter. The more you talk, the more you're apt to get into trouble. What do you think about this? Again, we popularly characterized people, and certainly there's some that are going to talk more than others and some that are going to be more quiet and restrained. He's saying the wise person's a quiet one. I mean, we're not as smart as we think we are. And if we talk too much, the more we just keep going, the more apt we are to get into trouble. And so the wise man knows how to restrain that. Chapter 12 and verse 16 says, "A fool's vexation is known at once, but a prudent man conceals dishonor. Says a fool will tell you everything he's angry about right up front, and how easy it is to do that. How easy it is to find fault and criticize everything and everybody around us. Everything that vexes us. Says a fool does that. Makes it all known all at once. Chapter 17, Proverbs chapter 17, verses 27 through 28. He who restrains his word has knowledge. His words has knowledge. And who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Although the idea of describing somebody as cool was modern lingo. The cool fella, the fella keeps his mouth shut. He has a cool spirit as a man of understanding. Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is counted wise. When he closes his lips, he is counted prudent. We have a little saying, it's better to, was it, to be silent and be thought a fool than to speak and remove all doubt. And it's kind of the same thing, just turned around the other way right here. But the point is not that you never say anything again. It's to realize how easily we can, as we say sometimes, speak before we think. How easily we can make a commitment that we're not quite ready to live up to. How easily we can criticize something thinking we know what was really going on when we didn't. How easily we can shade things in a moment of passion so that it's not quite the truth, so that in fact it's just enough of a misrepresentation of the truth to hurt somebody very badly, to alienate perhaps a friend that had been a friend for life. Well, our time has gotten away. There are lots of things to be said about the danger and entanglements of the tongue, the rash vow, the thoughtless joke, flattery, boasting, or just the outright lie. The point is, all of these things are traps, snares that Satan sets for us. And this book says, watch out for these things. They are dangerous, and they can destroy your life, destroy your soul. As I say sometimes in teaching on the Book of Proverbs doesn't really focus on how to be saved. It doesn't tell us what we need to do once our life has gotten messed up by sin. It tells us how to keep our life from getting messed up. But I suspect, even as we look at the things right here this morning, there's some that can look and say, this or that has been my favorite, the snare in which I've been caught. And it may be in any number of cases that perhaps even as we sing the invitation, it's a time to reflect on something that might need to be done privately to make one's life right with God and to make commitments to extricate ourselves, to seek God's help in that, in extricating ourselves from one or more of these snares. But it may be that there is somebody here who needs some public confession of sin in light of this, or perhaps someone who just realizes that these things have kept them from obeying the gospel, or other things as well. Ultimately, the only one that really gets us out of these snares is God, through forgiveness. He's the only one that can really come in and cut away all of the things that get tangled up around us. And sooner or later, we have to be ready to acknowledge His help if we find that that's where we are. And if you find yourself in that situation, then we extend the invitation with a song that's been selected that you might come and, if you need to obey the gospel, confess Jesus as your Lord and ask His help to be delivered from sin. Confess Him as Lord, repent of your sins that you might be baptized for the remission of those. If you're subject, we extend the invitation now as we stand and sing together.